This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Hope your main streets have been cleared and you can get out of your driveways and all that. We certainly had our challenges in the eastern part of the state on Monday. Today we're going to start our show talking with Ken Smith. He's a candidate for a doctorate in history at NDSU. His advisor is distinguished professor of history Tom Easer, and a very familiar voice on Main Street. And Ken joins us by phone from Ellendale, where he is with the Ellendale Historical Society. Thanks for being with us, Ken.
Well, thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about an exhibit that's coming up at the North Dakota Museum of Art at UND. It's titled Elmer Thompson, the Inventor, and Ellendale claims him, right?
Yes, indeed, we do. He attended the State Normal Industrial School here for 4 years, back from 1909 to 1913. And so he made a mark. He was the official school photographer, and his pictures are filling up the very first yearbook that they produced. And they're just remarkable photographs.
And he used a technique that was called glass plate photography. Describe that for our listeners.
Well, you know, Paul, my colleague who actually owns the plates, would be more expert in this area of the photography, of exactly how that works. But at the time, it was, I believe photography was tended to be much more complex than, of course, it became. And unless you had like a Kodak, you would obviously... You would expect to spend a pretty major amount of effort with your equipment. And so I think that for Elmer, at least, it wasn't considered to be that much of a burden, because with high-quality photography, and he used a 5x7 Conley camera, I think the effort was considered just part of the process.
Well, when people see this exhibit, Elmer Thompson, the Inventor, it runs from February 10th through March 10th at the North Dakota Museum of Art. What images will they see? What kind of story does it tell?
Well, it'll tell a story. First of all, he grew up in Cavalier County in Osnabrück Township is where he was born, and he experienced farm life. And so he, when he got his camera, he started taking photographs of various scenes on the farm, big barns and cattle and various things, thrashing machines, but he also did quite a lot of what we would call trick photography, quite a bit of double exposure work, and some of the glass plates just show a remarkable talent for using some of these techniques, and several of those will be on display. It also shows sort of a whimsical attitude that I kind of associate with him, and so he had a lot of fun with his photography, but it was also a serious stepping stone into a later career.
And this kind of photography required a pretty good-sized camera. You said 5x7. It still had a tripod because it had to be still. It took the exposures might have taken longer than we're normally used to with a camera. And again, the developing process required a lot of chemicals. It was wet plate. So were these images largely posed?
Yeah, the images were pretty carefully posed, and if you look, for example, I think one of the ones that visitors to the display will see, down at the Normal Industrial School, he had several really classic ones. One of them is about a 1908 Case steam tractor, and a class in mechanical engineering is standing outside, and he's got the tractor is posed so that the smokestack is right below the power plant that kept the college heated, and so it looks like the smoke is actually, you know, this big billow of smoke. It looks like it's coming out of the tractor, but it's actually coming out of the smokestack. Things like that. There's lots of clues that there's some pretty careful posing going on. He was very careful about that, and he studied it as well. He had a very good photography manual, and he seems to have followed a lot of the ideas in there.
One of the images that the North Dakota Museum of Art has tied to this exhibit is Fred Thompson holding a kitten. Is that a relation to Elmer?
Yes, that's his younger brother. Now, Fred also came to Ellendale, and he was also a photographer. In fact, he took over. A lot of his pictures are in the 1915 yearbook, which was the second yearbook, so he was here a little bit longer. But a lot of the pictures that we have were somewhere by Fred, not in the glass plate collection. The ones that will be seen at the display are all Elmer's. But they had a lot in common, a lot of common interests. And the two gentlemen looked a lot alike. And so sometimes when you look at their pictures in the yearbook and such, it's kind of hard to tell which is which.
Well, you mentioned that these images initially were 5x7 glass plates, and back in that day, they typically wouldn't have enlarged them. They would have been contact prints. So how are these presented in a museum?
Paul Grunhoved has printed these. He's got some really nice he's worked with a local exhibitor, designer, in terms of the design of the exhibit. And they're large format prints with a lot of white space around them and nice frames. Paul is actually, we actually did an initial display down here in Ellendale at the Ellendale Opera House in September. We got a very good response from that, and so we were just thrilled that the North Dakota Museum of Art wanted to show these. But he's actually reprinted these on finer paper to achieve an even better image. And so, I haven't seen the final product yet here of these, but I believe it's going to be really exceptional in terms of quality.
Well, these images, the glass plate images, are famously very finely detailed. So I think everybody would probably be intrigued to see these images bigger than life, if you will. How did Paul Grunhoved come to get these glass plates?
Well, first of all, Cavalier County, Osnabrück Township, is where the Thompson family had a farm there. And just like two farmsteads over was a Grunhoved family, which goes way back to the late 1800s, I believe. And when the Elmer Thompson family kept possession of that land, and they had a farmhouse there. And at some point, Elmer, I think before going off to New York City in 1920, he had brought a bunch of photographs back, these glass plates. They were kind of bulky, and they were in wooden crates, and had set them up into the attic. And so one of Paul's relatives had been exploring in the attic of this house that was really abandoned because they were renting the property from the Thompson family. And they told him that, you know, if you find anything in the house, you can have it, whatever. So he found all these glass plates. So it's sort of a treasure that he found, and that led him to reconnect with Elmer before he died. Now, he died in 1982, and so he was, I believe, 92 years old when he passed away. So they did reconnect, and Paul ended up, I don't know exact details, but he ended up owning some 300 of these.
Wow.
And being a graphics designer, of course, this was right down his alley. So he's had these for a number of years, and done various things with them, and he's wanted to promote these, and that's when I got in touch with Paul about 3 or 4 years ago, and we realized that we both had a big part of this Elmer Thompson story. Mine would be the Ellendale part and the historical background, and his would be the photograph, and so it was really a great opportunity to collaborate.
Well, this is an interesting snapshot of history, too, isn't it?
Well, it really is. Now, I've discovered a lot about Elmer Thompson that I didn't know initially. He was what I would say is part of a very fast-moving stream of technological advance. Now, for those listening, they may wonder, well, the inventor, what actually did he invent? Well, his degree from the University of California after he left here was in electrical engineering. From there, he went to AT&T and in New York City. He worked along with people who would later join what would be, there's a recent book that many listeners may have heard of called The Idea Factory, about Bell Labs. He worked with some of those people, including an engineer named David Grimes, who formed his own radio company, and Elmer worked for David after leaving AT&T for several years. Then the Grimes company went bankrupt because their circuitry, which had been the most advanced, was supplanted by something even better and cheaper, which is a common story in this whole field of electronics technology. And then he moved to Victor Talking Machines, which while he was there, they merged with RCA. RCA was destroyed really, or at least temporarily, in the stock market crash of 1929. 29, and shortly after that, Elmer lost his job at RCA. But he eventually rejoined David Grimes at Philco, and Grimes had become chief head engineer at Philco. And Philco was really interested in expanding the market for its radios. By the mid-30s, most households had at least one radio, and so they were trying to make improvements in style and design and functionality. And so that's kind of where Elmer came in. His two most famous inventions, which became really, really widely publicized, were in 1938, the Philco Mystery Control, which was the very first completely wireless radio remote control.
Magic.
You could control your Philco radio. You could change stations. You could program it to about 10 different stations. Wow. You could turn the volume up and down. It was a very sophisticated piece of equipment. It really sold well for a couple years. Then the war came along, and there was a big shift out of the consumer market. That was really a major invention, and it gained a lot of notoriety, and it inspired a lot of people. It ended up being in a major movie called Topper Takes a Trip, which is the old Topper series, which I'll be talking about there. But then the other invention that was most interesting was the Philco Beam of Light system. And this was a phonograph pickup that replaced the old steel needle with a sapphire, which sapphires and diamonds would ultimately become standard. But the unique thing about this was that Elmer connected a little mirror, a tiny little mirror, to the sapphire, and as it rode in the record groove, it would vibrate. A photoelectric cell would shine light on that, and then there was a photoelectric pickup. And the vibrations of the record thus would be transferred into the amplification system via a beam of light, literally. And so this
shades of television almost, yeah.
Well, and it reminds people of the compact disc technology, although
yes.
This is not digital. This is just simply picking up the vibrations and channeling them by means of light. Now, this went really big for a couple of years, and it was widely advertised. It was a light tracking system, and it replaced that steel needle that required a lot of pressure and tended to wear out the records really quickly. So this is another example of technology that was very cutting edge for several years. But then you get the electromagnetic cartridges and another, I think there are two or three different types of magnetic or electrical or electrostatic cartridges that eventually would replace that. But it's really a collector's item, and radio enthusiasts and radio and phonograph enthusiasts would all know about probably the Beam of Light. It's a very highly desirable collector's item.
Elmer O. Thompson, he's a farm boy from Cavalier, North Dakota, who goes to his school in Ellendale, goes on to University of California, Signal Corps, and during World War I, he works for AT&T, RCA, Victor, Philco. He gets all these patents. Did he become rich because of this?
He says, now, most of the information we have about him comes from about a 35-minute interview that he did 2 years before he died. And he's asked that question in the interview, and he indicates that he received, I can't quote it, but it was, I think, about $2,000 for each patent. He seems to have been very pleased with the amount of remuneration that he received for his patents. So I think he did pretty well. In his retirement, he was able to travel widely. He always took cameras and movie cameras with him, and he would entertain his friends at his retirement, where he retired in DeBary, Florida. And he would show them slideshows and films that he'd taken of deep sea fishing and traveling in France and traveling in the Pacific Islands and such, and so he was a very interesting person. Would have been very interesting to know the gentleman.
Well, so his love of photography continued. Is there any interest at the Ellendale Historical Society, that operation you're involved with, about kind of continuing this story?
Indeed. We're just a kind of a volunteer operation, just a little small operation. We've got a nice historic building that we're in, but we just rely on pretty much just volunteer stuff. And I tend to be kind of the head person there. But it definitely is a way to kind of draw attention, well, not only to our local museum and our local history, but also to the state and the fact that, you know, lots of really, really creative people came out of these rural communities. And I think that's something that is not appreciated so much. And one of my goals as a historian is to really call attention to that and to make people more aware of the contributions of North Dakotans and people from the upper Midwest and the Northern Plains in significant contributions that have been made.
Well, some listeners to this program may recall, I recall, that the North Dakota State Normal and Industrial School at Ellendale existed for quite a while. It burned down in about 50 years ago, but it was an important institution in the state for a while.
Yeah, there were literally thousands of teachers that went out of here, and really mostly in the upper Midwest, but they actually went all over the country, and the school had quite a reputation. And if you look at, looking at the kind of curriculum that they had, it was a surprisingly advanced, it was surprisingly broad liberal arts type of thing. You would think a school by the name of a normal and industrial school would be a little more along the utilitarian lines, but I think it found a pretty good balance throughout most of its history, at least, a pretty good balance between the liberal arts and the more utilitarian type of things in education. And so that whole balance between the liberal arts and the technical / scientific / utilitarian vocational type of thing has always been of great interest to me. And I know that people that are involved in higher education, it's a question that comes up again and again about, what is the proper balance between the arts and the sciences? And so this is a little bit of a historic window, at least a chance to kind of look into that question.
And it's a reminder that Ellendale was one of those institutions that was mentioned in the state constitution back in 1889.
Yes, indeed. In fact, when the two buildings burnt down, they were the two early buildings dating from 1899 and 1902, the two main buildings burnt down. Pretty soon it became clear that the state was not going to fund a rebuilding of these things. And so in order to change the Constitution, there actually had to be a referendum, which was completed in 1972. And then Trinity Bible Institute, which was a pretty thriving school in Jamestown, had a pretty good president, Roy H. Weed, and it was connected pretty well politically around the state. And they managed to take possession of the campus, which was kind of an unusual thing historically. It's a public asset becoming a private asset. So there's issues in terms of controversy over that. But for the most part, the people of Ellendale, I think, have been very happy that they were able to continue a school in Ellendale. And it's Trinity's been a pretty good citizen and definitely highly valued within the community and within the area to this day.
Well, it's a reminder that there's a lot of history out there. Some of it is very intriguing, and of course, that's your interest. You're an NDSU PhD candidate in history. What's your dissertation going to cover? Some of these things we've been talking about?
Well, it will. What I'm doing, my working title is Dusty Town. Now, the Dusty Town is D-U-S-T-I-E. The mascot for the State Normal Industrial School adopted in the mid-20s was the Dusties. And a number of individuals in the town who some of them grew up with the town, lived their careers out here, others whose careers intersected. I have about 6 or 8, maybe a little more, of individuals who I'll do short biographies, and each one sort of illuminates a part of the town's history. So that's essentially what I'm looking at in terms of my dissertation.
Well, the emphasis right now is on Elmer Thompson, the inventor. This exhibit opens February 10th, runs through March 10th at the North Dakota Museum of Art on the campus of the University of North Dakota. Thank you, Ken Smith, for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I sure appreciate it.
Coming up next, we'll hear from Ken's advisor, Tom Ezern, who shares another art history story in an essay titled The Duck Stamp Guy.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hey, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public, and thanks and congratulations, too, to everybody who joined up or renewed the short and sweet membership drive. Delicious cocoa truffles going out all over the place, and it's wonderful. If you haven't joined already, well, you can. You can call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org up till February 8th. That's the deadline. So if you still want to get in on it, you can. Let's hear from you, and thanks to everybody who helped.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public, and thank you for doing that. I'm Doug Hamilton. When Tom Eason isn't working with students, he could be writing a Plainsfolk essay. Tom writes and voices these essays for our Main Street listeners, which offer intriguing snippets of history unique to the Upper Great Plains. Today, Tom's essay is titled, The Duck Stamp Guy.
Waterfowl hunters, check your wallet, and you will see that this year's duck stamp, now known as a migratory bird hunting and conservation stamp, but who calls it that anyway? This year's duck stamp features a pair of mallards. It is a return to the roots of the program. The first federal duck stamp, issued in 1934, also bore the likeness of a mallard pair. The man who sketched those immortal birds in 1934 was J. Norwood Darling, a figure celebrated in the history of conservation and profiled in a biography by David L. Lent entitled Ding, The Life of J. Norwood Darling. Born in Michigan, Darling grew up in Iowa. Following college, he began a career as a political cartoonist in 1906, drawing first for the Sioux City Journal and then for the Des Moines Register. He signed his cartoons, which won him two Pulitzer Prizes, simply as Ding. So I'll call him that from here on. Ding was a conservative Republican. This is worth mentioning because the duck stamp program is a success story of federal initiative. In 1934, Democratic President Franklin Roosevelt appointed Ding director of the United States Biological Survey, now known as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Ding was a notable exponent of wildlife conservation, but some said FDR made the appointment also to bring one of his most effective critics inside the tent. Within a few days, Congress passed and FDR signed the Migratory Bird Hunting Stamp Act. This was the authorization for the duck stamp, with sales going to fund acquisition and maintenance of strategic wildlife habitat, mainly wetlands on the prairies. The great drought of the 1930s was on, and waterfowl numbers were crashing, and wildlife biologists had come to realize that as the prairies go, so goes the waterfowl population. So the causative origins of the duck stamp program are on the Great Plains, and it is here that the program has done its greatest work. The artwork for the first duck stamp was done by none other than Ding himself, sketching on pieces of cardboard that had come with his dress shirts back from the cleaners. He intended his sketches to be mere prototypes, but the printers got ahead of him. Here in North Dakota, the Upper Souris Wildlife Refuge, established in 1935, is a direct product of the system initiated by Ding. The 9,600-acre lake in the refuge is named Lake Darling. Ding said of his work that he was the custodian of all the wildlife species that exist. Noah started it. I think he must have been the first member of the Biological Survey. He built the ark to save a pair of all wildlife. The only difference between Noah and my personal experience is that he started out in a flood and I started out in a drought. We have driven game back to the river margins, the raw, ragged edges of this country, Darling cried. We have changed from the old period when game was a part of our life, but the instinct still remains with us. We are only one generation removed from it. We are not doing this for the hunters, he said. I should not be here if all that I was doing was making it possible for people to go out and kill game. My chief interest lies in restoring America to itself. I do not know what is in the minds of my fellow prairie waterfowlers when they take their retrievers to the marsh each autumn. But I hope that their hearts harbor the noble sentiments of Ding Darling.
That's Tom Ezern, who's the author of Pacing Dakota, a collection of stories drawn from his Plainsfolk essays, now available in bookstores. Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media updates the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China, and we'll meet North Dakota's flipper pinball champion as he prepares for the national contest in Las Vegas. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The director of suicide prevention in the State Department of Human Services says it is very important to have community-based behavioral health treatment to help people before they decide to take their own lives. Allison Traynor says since 1999, the suicide rate in North Dakota has increased more than any other state. She says her program is partnering with the behavioral health and recovery programs to help reduce that rate.
Most people who struggle with suicidal ideation actually get help and recover. They reach out for help, and there is help to be found.
Traynor says the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available in North Dakota and is answered here by First Link.
And they also provide caring follow-up contact through the callback program. We also have a program that's upstream suicide prevention and substance use prevention called Sources of Strength, and that help kids develop resiliency and learn from one another how to use their strengths to get better and recover.
Traynor says her program receives a lot of calls from individuals, especially in rural North Dakota, who want to set up support groups and other community-based services. She says her office provides training for local people. The suicide prevention hotline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Governor Burgum appeared before a legislative committee today to push for the proposal to create three separate boards of higher education. The bill before the House Education Committee would implement the change if voters approve it. It would create separate boards for UND and NDSU and another board for the nine other campuses. Burgum told the committee,
"What we're proposing is that we adopt a mission-focused governance system where we can empower the North Dakota higher education institutions to compete better in this ever-changing marketplace. Two boards with focused missions around workforce and research, working directly with their respective institutions' presidents, can and will more quickly respond to the needs of the state."
There's been talk of changing the proposal to two boards, one for two research universities and the other for the other campuses, as well as to keep the single board, but expand its membership to lengthen the terms of board members. The committee did not take immediate action. And Montana Dakota Utilities began providing natural gas service to Doosan Bobcat in Gwinner last fall and will now expand that service to residential customers in Gwinner and nearby Milner. A 21-mile pipeline that tapped into the Alliance Pipeline northeast of Milner and southwest of Gwinner began supplying Doosan Bobcat with natural gas last September. Mark Hansen is spokesman for MDU. He says the company is currently in a 15-year service agreement with Doosan Bobcat and worked with the mayors of Gwinner and Milner to expand that service to those communities. He says each community is home to roughly 700 to 800 people. He says natural gas service will provide them with several affordable options.
Having that big anchor customer is really what made it affordable to extend it on to both the communities as well. So it is an opportunity for customers to hook up to that, you know, real cost-effective gas source or, you know, fuel source for heating their home and water. And, you know, if they hook up other, you know, gas appliances like a fireplace or grill, gives them, you know, a lot of opportunities.
Hansen says the service will be ready for customers by the fall of 2019. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Last week, we had our short and sweet membership drive here on Prairie Public and on Main Street. And just a reminder that you can still get in on it if you want to. Contribute $10 a month as a sustaining member, and we'll send out a box of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry anywhere in the continental U.S. $15 a month, get two boxes, 23 boxes. You can do the math. At any rate, for those of you who have supported Main Street and Prairie Public by becoming members, thank you. And here's one of the reasons you listen, because all you hear about the U.S. and China trade war is that it's bad for manufacturing and farmers. However, farmers are mostly collateral damage in this international struggle over power and technology. In the first of a three-part series of reports, Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck explains why.
Intellectual property theft costs the U.S. at least $225 billion a year, according to the National Bureau of Asian Research. And the country that does it the most is China. But that's nothing new. Or in other words,
this is not all about Trump.
That's Aaron Friedberg, a Princeton University professor who's been watching U.S.-China trade relations for about 20 years.
He is reacting to complaints and pressures that have been building up for over a decade.
Friedberg says China's government has abused U.S. markets and trade a lot of different ways over the last few decades. But generally what happens is that government incentivizes its companies to acquire and improve technologies from foreign competition. Sometimes Chinese companies get that technology in illegal ways, like through cyber attacks and outright stealing of robot arms. Friedberg says that a few decades ago, China's infractions weren't as big of a deal.
If you go back to the 90s and even into the early 2000s, Chinese industries were lagging considerably behind their Western counterparts. And so if they were cutting corners and doing things to promote the development of less advanced industries, I think the feeling was that this didn't matter so much.
But that's changed. The U.S. still leads the world in high-tech production, but China is a close number two and aims to grow. That's according to the U.S. Trade Representative Office, which advises the president on trade. The Chinese government has signed agreements to stop some of its illegal or unfair practices over the years, but a U.S. investigation in 2017 found that these things are still happening, like verbal backroom agreements that aren't on paper. So Friedberg says,
even when the Chinese haven't broken the rules, they've sort of bent them.
Previous administrations knew this was a problem and tried to pressure China. Friedberg says their actions didn't go far enough to stop China's bad actions at that time. But Ron Kirk was the U.S. trade representative for 4 years under President Barack Obama and stands by his work. He says they addressed American concerns by suing China multiple times through the World Trade Organization.
The one thing Americans were most frustrated about, they felt nobody ever held these people that weren't playing by the rules, our partners that weren't playing by the rules, feet to the fire.
But both he and Friedberg agree that Trump's approach to tackling this issue could be more effective if we worked with allies. Allies like Canada, which the Trump administration has put steel tariffs on. Right now, the U.S. is largely taking on China alone. China has fought back by putting tariffs on Trump's political base, part of which is farmers in rural America. Farm groups across the U.S. have voiced concerns and encouraged the president to find at least some short-term relief for trade. But at the same time, David Salmonson of the American Farm Bureau says they don't expect an overall trade agreement right away.
We know this has to be a longer-term process.
Ag hasn't been spared when it comes to intellectual property theft, though. One Chinese national was convicted of stealing corn seeds to send back to China for analysis. Plus, China has indicated it wants to grow and become a major competitor in the ag tech sector. So Salmonson says that ag isn't an island when you look at the big picture.
Since we're all a part of this relationship, yeah, it does. It affects everybody.
Some are concerned that the president may declare complete victory too soon after getting concessions over agriculture, that he'll walk away without significantly changing China's actions. If this happens, or trade negotiations go south, China's growing dominance in the world economy could create divisions in world trade. That wouldn't be the end of the world. Trade would just look more like it did during major wars as different countries traded in blocks. But it could mean everyday goods become more expensive in the U.S., a nation full of companies that depend on the international economy. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
That was the first installment of Harvest Public Media's three-part series exploring the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China. To read more about the issue, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. Coming up on Main Street, a pinball wizard from Fargo.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring a Valentine's package February 14th through the 16th that includes a guest room, four-course dinner for two, and wine or a sparkling cider delivered to your room. 701-232-7363 or RadissonFargo.com.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him.
Well, we could not resist playing the Pinball Wizard from by The Who, of course, a classic piece of rock and roll. And we're going to talk about pinball with a pinball wizard, Tim Fichtner is the North Dakota pinball champion as of the middle of January, and he's going to the International Flipper Pinball Association Championship in March in Las Vegas. Thanks for being with us, Tim.
Well, thanks for having me.
What attracts you to pinball?
Roger Daltrey said, the little silver ball. I've always been attracted to hand-eye coordination games like that, and it's a lot of fun.
How long have you been playing?
Ever since I was a kid. We had a pinball machine in our basement, which I still have in my basement to this day, an old Fireball home machine from the mid to late 70s, and still works and still occasionally play it.
Well, they used to be in most bars, at least of a certain kind, and pool halls, and they were around a lot more than they are today. Where do you play now?
There's a place called Fargo Pinball. It actually originated in downtown, but now it's in South Fargo, South University, right across the street from the Fargo Cork. And it's a club, so it's a membership only, but there are tournaments and it's available for birthday parties and other events, and they also sell and lease and rent machines. So, without Fargo Pinball, I wouldn't be going to any national tournament. So I'd like to thank Bill and Jim and Emily Brooks just for taking over Fargo Pinball and giving me the opportunity and a place to play.
And you won the state championship. How was that conducted?
Well, it's the top 16 players in the state, and you're seated accordingly based on your play throughout the year. And then it's match play, so it's the best of seven, first of four victories. And the first person, the higher seed, gets the choice of whether they want to pick the game or the order. You can go first or second. So generally the players will pick the game, and the other player gets the choice then of order, and they'll generally go second. I mean, this isn't set in stone, but it's just nice to go second sometimes.
Well, is it on the final score? How is it scored? Is it the game score?
Yeah, it's a game score. The tilts are set really tight, so you can't do a lot of bumping of the machine. It's three balls and you're done. All extra balls are eliminated. So it's just your test of how you can use the flippers.
Well, the pinball, for those of you who have never played the game, and for that those few of you who haven't seen it played, it's three big steel balls. You've got flippers, and the idea is to keep the ball in play and making points, right?
That's right. Yep. So the best score wins, and that's typically how it goes. But a lot of different variations of the games. From the 70s all the way to, they continue to make them, and they're in different genres of music or movie or television shows. So they're all unique in their own right, too, but you can see the similarities.
What's the longest you've kept a ball in play?
Well over half an hour.
Wow. That's incredible. So what kind of a score do you get if you keep a ball in play for half an hour?
Well, we try to become the grand champion of all the games that are there. So goal is to get the high score. And
I think my best might have been a minute. So how is the thing conducted in Las Vegas? Because you said the machines are, tightly conforming to not being tilted or manipulated in a sense.
Yep.
Are you playing the same game? Are you playing on the same machine?
They have given the list of machines. Fargo Pinball has got about 30 different machines, and the list that we're playing has about 25. And Fargo Pinball actually has three of those machines, so I can practice on those because, again, I'll be playing head-to-head against one of the other state winners. I think there's 53 total. They took a couple from Canada and maybe one of the other provinces. But so it's just me against one guy at a time until we get to – hopefully I'll make it past the first round. I don't think North Dakota's ever advanced past stage one, but we're gonna shoot for that.
Well, I noticed that you're ranked 3,856th in the International Flipper Pinball Association ranking. So how many people are in the rankings?
Boy, I think it's well over 15 to 20,000, but that doesn't sound very good when you say it like that. I know I played against a guy from Minneapolis who was ranked like 40th, and we were pretty competitive. So once you get into that top, dare I say, 4,000, you're pretty good.
So where does it take place in Las Vegas?
It's a place called Flipperspiel, and so maybe the German connection with my Fichtner, German heritage, will bode well for me down there. But
Flipper play, that means.
Yes, that's right.
Does your ranking put you way back in the seating?
Yeah. So I'll more than likely be playing someone who's one of the top players in the world.
Well, I went online to the ifpapinball.com website.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across the rankings, and right now the current top guy is a 26-year-old by the name of Raymond Davidson. But the guy who's considered the world's greatest pinball player, at least on that website, is Keith Elwin. Davidson is 26. Elwin is 47.
And I'm 46, so I'm right in that mix too. But there's another – there are several players who are little boys. I'm talking teenagers who are in the top 50 in the world. And so you can start as early as you want. You can start as late as you want. That's kind of the beauty of pinball. There's no age discrepancy or discrimination at all.
So when you play, are you in the zone? Because this is going to be a national championship. I suppose there might be some distractions there, like a crowd, cameras, maybe, noise.
You know, that's one thing that I try and eliminate. And rather than use headphones and pump music in, that kind of takes me away from the game. So I like to be as zoned into the game as I can and just eliminate the noise and the outside distractions.
Now, the machines were always these electromechanical marvels to me.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, some of these machines can be idiosyncratic. When you push the flipper button, sometimes it doesn't instantly go.
Absolutely.
So how well-tuned are these machines and what technological advances might have been applied to their creation?
Well, that's a good point that you make. And actually, there's only a one-hour practice session before the National. So even if I decided to fly down to Las Vegas early to try and get an early practice session in, I wouldn't be able to do it. They will tweak the machines the day before. And so really, no one gets any extra prep time on those machines until that 1 hour before the event starts.
Well, in the old days when I played, and I didn't play well or very long, there used to be maybe one or two, maybe three machines in a bar or a pool hall, and the etiquette was somebody would put a quarter on the machine
if
they were going to play next. Is there still etiquette?
Not really. Because of the location or the number of machines that Fargo Pinball has, there's never really anyone waiting. I actually just came from playing against the two-time was defending state champion. We play head-to-head just to kind of practice and gear up for that head-to-head match play, which is the same that I'm going to face in Las Vegas. So he's also going to Las Vegas. There's a tournament called the Pin Masters that bookends. It's after the national championship, but it's 3 days long.
Okay. So how much time do you spend playing pinball to, keep your eye-hand coordination fresh?
If my wife is listening, not very much time at all. Maybe 20, 30 minutes a week. But truly, a couple hours at least I like to put in a week. It's nice to have a machine at home because even though – each machine is different, you still get that feeling in your fingers and in your brain. I mean, it's definitely got both hemispheres working. With stroke victims even, I think pinball has been proven to be helpful in their recovery just because it uses both sides of your brain. And to be able to tap into that and to, see somebody smile who hasn't in a while is a neat thing too.
I'm still marveling at the fact that you kept a ball in play for an hour.
Well, I said a half hour, I think. But
well, a half hour is pretty impressive too. So how long does a championship game contest take?
It depends, again, because if a match goes all seven games, I'd say the minimum one game takes is maybe 3 to 5 minutes. So you're looking at least – I played against Dan Stephanie today for – it was an hour and a half. And we went to game seven, and unfortunately he got me, but I'll get him next time.
So this is a best of seven?
Best of seven.
Okay, and do you know who you're going to be competing with? Do you know some of the records of these other guys?
I know that they're all very good players and that I'm a huge underdog, but I go after it with an open mind, and I'm going to give it my best and prepare as much as I can. I'll be there the day before, and I'll go check out the place, and I'll obviously be there for the practice session. But other than that, I can just keep my skills as honed as they are up here, or maybe travel to Minneapolis and play in an event or two. They also have a couple of machines that will be played in the national tournament that are not here, so you can get a little practice in on those machines.
So there is this world pinball ranking.
Yeah.
Are upsets common?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Anything can happen in these things. There is a lot of luck involved, and I should say maybe bad luck, you know, bad bounces, you know, that you just can't anticipate. But you definitely see the cream of the crop rise to the top as well. I mean, some of these guys' flipper skills are just beyond belief what they can do with. It's like a juggler, except with their, you know, juggling ping pong balls out of their mouth or something.
Well, if you've seen the movie, the Pinball Wizard, or you know, Tommy is the movie, yep. or the stage presentation of it, you know the tilt plays a role as well. So in these championship games, you can't beat on the machine, I take it, because they used to take a fair amount of abuse. People used to, you know, work out their frustrations on the pinball machine.
They'll be set so tight that if you flip too hard, they'll tilt.
Wow.
So it's really a skill to just be able to keep that ball in play and control the silver ball. That's what it's about, control and patience.
Are these machines hard to maintain?
You know, at first glance, you would think they wouldn't be, but yes, they are. I mean, whether it's just I don't even know what a fuse shorting out or something coming loose after wear. But that's again where I thank Bill and Jim so much for having Fargo Pinball around, because they're the ones who maintain the machines all the time as well.
Well, as I mentioned, and as probably you know, many years ago there were a lot more pinball machines generally around.
Sure.
Is it coming back?
I think it is. Yeah, I think you'll see it a lot more. Actually, Fargo Pinball brought 8 new machines over to the Drecker Brewhalla new location, and they're all doing extremely well. They're always very busy whenever I go over there. And neat facility. You should go check that out if you haven't seen it yet.
Well, I have to check that out. I've heard a lot about it. Now, this used to be mostly a guy thing. Is that still the case?
It is not. There are very many women playing pinball, and a lot of, you know, again, it doesn't, it transcends gender, it transcends age. It's really very, it's open to everyone.
So, when you get to Las Vegas, have you ever attended one of these championship things before?
I have not. But I've been to Vegas several times.
Oh, okay, so you know what kind of a place it is.
I do. It's the Flipperspiel is off. It's way off the strip, so there shouldn't be a whole lot of distractions. So I'm hoping to, you know, really focus on what I'm there to do.
Now, I assume because this is the International Flipper Pinball Association and this is the national championship, there's an international one too?
There is. Yeah, I believe the winner of this then will attend. It's in Greece this year.
Oh, boy.
It's in June.
How many people typically show up at one of these events besides the players? Does it draw a crowd?
Well, again, I never have personally been, but since it is, you know, of the highest order in the pinball world, I would assume that there will be a few onlookers, yes. And then, again, there's that Pin Golf Pin Masters tournament that follows this tournament for 3 days. So that's got – I started out as 21st alternate. I'm now second alternate, and that's kind of frozen, but I hope that a couple guys don't show up, so I get into that too.
Can we follow this? Is it going to stream live or something?
I believe it will stream live. I don't have that information on me. I'm sorry. But if you just, you know, go to that IFPA site, ifpapinball.com, you can find out any information you want. And yeah.
Well, we'll be following North Dakota's best. Tim Fichtner is the 2019 North Dakota Pinball Champion. He's going to be at the National Championship in March in Las Vegas. Congratulations and best wishes.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Dakota Datebook is next.
FM Opera's North of Normal Chamber Opera Series presents Three Decembers. This dark comedy explores the life of an overbearing Broadway diva, featuring fan favorite Lucy Thrasher, who has ignored her now adult children while pursuing her career. Looking back over 3 decades at Christmas, this heartwarming and sometimes tragic story reveals the tangled emotions of their family history. Performances February 15th and 17th at Weld Hall, MSUM. Tickets at fmopera.org or 701-239-4558.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 5th. It was on this date, in 1949, that the North Dakota National Guard was called upon to drop feed for stranded, starving animals in the western part of the state, where a storm had dumped 16 inches of snow. Anybody who has lived in North Dakota for any length of time knows about snowstorms. The state is often accused of being the worst of the lower 48 states for winter weather, but surprisingly, many of our records are surpassed by other states. In terms of duration, the worst blizzard on record blasted the entire Upper Plains from March 2nd to the 5th in 1966. In Broken Bow, Nebraska, the wind gusted to more than 100 miles per hour, leaving snowdrifts 40 feet high. In Bismarck, visibility was zero for 42 consecutive hours, and a new record for single-storm snowfall was set at 22.4 inches. Meanwhile, 35 inches fell in Mobridge, South Dakota. The most deadly blizzard in North Dakota's modern history hit on March 15, 1941, killing 79 people, 39 in North Dakota, 32 in Minnesota, and 8 in Canada. Winds gusted to 85 miles per hour at Grand Forks, and snowdrifts reached 12 feet in north-central Minnesota. Early settlers were particularly vulnerable to winter storms. Immigrant Agatha Jarrell wrote of a storm in 1889, saying, "One morning the sun was shining, but it was 20 or 25 degrees below zero. Just before noon, everything seemed to change. The sun disappeared from sight, and before anyone realized what had happened, the storm was here. My husband had gone to Wimbledon after a load of coal and was halfway home when the storm started. He knew too well an old-fashioned blizzard was approaching. Driving into a farm, he unhitched his team and put them in the barn." Being worried about Agatha, he started for home on foot. He grew stiff and cold. Crossing a field, he finally saw a light, which drew him to a house. He pounded on the door, and when it flew open, he fell to the floor. When he woke up, he was lying on a bed in a home 10 miles north of his farm. Others were not so lucky. Several froze to death, and many bodies were not found until spring. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Just a minute or so left here in Main Street to remind you that if you want to invest in Main Street's technology, its people, its stories, you know, it costs money and we need support. So if you want to get in on our short and sweet membership drive, you still have some time till Friday, the 8th, and we'll send a box of Nicole's Fine Truffles to anywhere in the continental U.S. before Valentine's Day. But you have to commit to $10 a month for that one box as a sustaining member, and you can do it by calling 800-359-4145 or going online to prairiepublic.org. For those who have, thank you. Wednesday, we'll talk to Dr. Gatluak Toch, founder of a Nashville organization to help refugees and immigrants succeed in their new surroundings. Dr. Toch will be the keynote speaker at a Fargo event. And The Banker in the Blackfoot looks at frontier settlement along the U.S.-Canadian border. We'll talk with author J. Edward Chamberlain about his story of two friends who wanted to accommodate tribal sovereignty and settlers. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.